Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Before we get started, and I'm really excited to get started because we have a very exciting guest, but I want to make sure that everyone that's listening is aware that this is my radio program. My name is Daniel Duvall, and my website can be found at www.bridemovement.com. Now, on that site, you'll find links to this radio program, other teachings and information, and so forth. You'll also find information about the vision of the ministry and books that I've written and so forth. The books that I have authored that are presently available are Noah's Ark and the End of Days and also Wounded by Leadership. Now, Noah's Ark and the End of Days is an expose on the last days and the plans that God has regarding his church in light of all that's coming. Wounded by Leadership is a book on how to deal with and overcome the wounds that we have taken from injurious experiences with leadership, particularly spiritual leadership, a major problem that a lot of people have run into as they have tried to move forward in their Christian faith, in their walk with Jesus, or just in life in general. They have come up against situations where leadership has really done them wrong and haven't known how to deal with and overcome those issues. And so those two books are available. Again, my name is Dan Duvall. Take a look at them. Now, this week, I'm very excited because we're going to be talking about a lot of relevant issues dealing with our economy, the future of our economy, money in general. And, you know, one of the really big issues expounded upon by the Word of God is the issue of money. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, the Bible actually talks more about money than it does about love or joy or some of these other elements that are so central to our understanding of the faith. And so the idea is God wants us to be faithful stewards and to understand, have understanding, knowledge, comprehension, so that, you know, he can have us positioned for what he wants and have us responsible with what he gives us. Now, our guest this week is named Jerry Robinson. Now, Jerry is an economist. He's a serial entrepreneur, an international speaker, and radio host of the program Follow the Money Weekly. You can find his website, and I'll make sure that he gives it to you later on in the program. And if you're listening to this on Blog Talk, you'll also be able to find it in the sidebar, www.ftmdaily.com. You can also find him featured on WorldNet Daily's popular website on a weekly basis, WND.com. He writes articles for them and so forth. He's appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including Fox News. He's been quoted by USA Today and even other agencies on the topic of the economy and has had columns appearing in publications such as Town Hall and Financial Sense. Now, Jerry isn't just a guest that I randomly contacted. I've actually known Jerry for some time. I met him years ago when he was conducting a forum, so to speak. He called it Veritas. His slogan was encouraging believers to think and thinkers to believe. And he's certainly a deep thinker with a teaching gift to make very difficult concepts very easy to understand, particularly when it comes to monetary issues, the economy, and so forth. So, without further ado, I want to go ahead and introduce our guest. Now, Jerry, are you with us?
I am, Daniel. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. That's so nice. Great to be here.
Thank you, man. I'm so glad you're here. I have a ton of respect for you, what you have done with the gifts God has given you. And I'm really excited that you've taken the time to be with us on this program, because what you know, I believe, is something that we as the body of Christ and even those that are just thinking outside of the box, so to speak, regarding the economy and where things are going, things we need to understand and embrace. And, you know, there's so much. Now, you've written a book. It's called Bankruptcy of Our Nation. I have it right here for those of you that are watching on the live feed. Outstanding book. I just finished it today. Why don't you just give us a little introduction? Who is Jerry Robinson, and what's the journey that ultimately led you to writing this book, which is now in its revised and expanded version after having become a bestseller?
Well, first of all, I want to say thanks for having me on the program again, Daniel, and I respect you as well. I know that you have, you know, sensed the call of God on your life for some time, and it's been really neat to watch that unfold and blossom. So I'm honored to be on your radio program, which I think is really quite spectacular. I've kind of went back and kind of checked out what you're doing, and I'm really proud. And also the website that you're running and the ministry and just the vision, I think, is really good. And so those who are listening, I think that you guys are locked into a good show here with Daniel. The book itself is, Daniel, it's about money. It's the reason that I wrote it goes back to who I am as an individual, as a person. I was raised in Jehovah's Witnesses, so I was out knocking on doors, you know, Saturday mornings. I was out trying to win people to Jehovah's kingdom. I was very zealous for the things of Jehovah, and it was about the age of 16 or 17 when I actually kind of, you know, got that dumb that dumbness just kind of comes on you when you're a teenager, and I backslid. And there's nothing worse. I don't know anybody who, you know, in your audience who's been part of a false cult before, but there is absolutely nothing worse than being a backslidden cult member. You know, even the cults don't want you at that point. And that's exactly where I was. I mean, I was scraping the bottom of the barrel. And I felt so cheated as I went back and looked at Jehovah's Witnesses whenever they kicked me out and I was done with them. And I was, it's really a miracle that I was even approached by someone about Christ and that I even responded, because I was so upset by being, you know, tricked, as it were, by my own parents. You know, which they didn't even realize they were being tricked by their parents. But anyone who's been part of a cult can testify to the fact that there's a lot of brainwashing that goes on. Well, that brainwashing, Daniel, is what I had to escape. It took me about 10 years after being born again to fully embrace the simplicity of the gospel, because I had so complicated it through the previous brainwashing that I had had with Jehovah's Witnesses. And one of the things that God brought on my heart early on was this understanding of money. I've always had a passion for the markets. I've always had a passion for economy and economics and the global economy. This stuff's always just fascinated me. And there's an old scripture, there's an old saying in the Bible, Jesus speaking, says you cannot serve two masters, you cannot serve both God and money. And I remember that's exactly what I wanted to study. I thought it was a very bizarre thing. I remember even talking to my college counselor at the time, and they were perplexed as to why I would want to study theology and economics. It was a strange hybrid. But nevertheless, I saw an intersection there. I saw something there that needed to be either exposed or revealed. And sure enough, the more I have delved into this topic, the more I have seen, as you pointed out, the fact that God's people have been fleeced, they have been lied to, and no doubt that money, as you pointed out, is mentioned in the Bible so many times by Jesus, by others, parables about money, about stewardship, about wealth, about possessions. And the reason is, it's not because God wants us all driving a Lamborghini or he all wants us living in air-conditioned homes. The reason that he talks about money so much is because he knows that it's the chief competitor for our heart. We don't necessarily know that, but he knows that. And therefore, he is constantly in his word trying to help us realize that there's so much deception. And I tell you, the enemy of our souls, Satan himself, has certainly used money very effectively against the Church of God. He's used money very effectively against the work of God and those who are trying to build the kingdom. They get distracted by money. They get distracted by so many different things when it comes to wealth and possessions and all of this. So it's a topic that I found a lot of interest in, and the book was really the culmination of all of the study that I had done. The book was released initially in 2008 or 2009, and it became a bestseller because it came out just as the economic crisis was really coming to a head. The reason that we're having this show now, I guess, is because of the new revised and expanded edition. That occurred because the publisher realized that many of these numbers had changed. I'll give you a quick example. When I wrote the first book back in 2008, 2009, the national debt was $9 trillion. $9 trillion. Well, now everybody knows that it's $16 trillion. It's practically doubled in just the 4 years, you know, between the first publication of the book and the second edition. So, you know, we're certainly in a economic emergency, and the publisher was wise enough to recognize that, and they asked me to write an updated version, and that's the book that you have in your hand.
Yes. Yeah, it's just been incredible how much our national debt has increased. The number trillion, you know, it gets thrown around like the word love or peace, trillion. I mean, it's people just don't get just how much money that really is. But before we get into issues facing this nation and kind of talking, like unwrapping, so to speak, some of these concepts and just insights and revelations you've communicated through your book. I want to have you just explain some of the basics. This getting started with basics for those that are listening to this program. Maybe they haven't really ever fully understood money at all. And so, first of all, I want to ask you, is money the root of all evil? Why or why not?
Well, I talk about that in the book, Daniel. I remember having this conversation with a lady, I'll never forget her, her name was Margaret, and she was very adamant that my talking about money was an offense to God, because she had been told, or she had believed that she had read, that the Bible speaks of in 1 Timothy chapter 6, that money is the root of all evil. And, of course, that's not what it says. But many people hear it that way. They look at money as a dirty thing. They view money as a very filthy thing. We're even told, you know, when we're younger, not to put, you know, coins are dirty. Don't put them in your mouth. You know, you ever see kids, you know, kind of putting a penny in their mouth or something. It's dirty. It's filthy. Well, that's obviously the physical realm. But even that transforms and transcends even into the spiritual realm and even into the emotional realm. It goes beyond that, and many people view money as filthy. All of it depends upon your family financial philosophy. How were you raised? Your parents really did inform your economic viewpoint. The Bible actually tries to refashion or reform our understanding of what money is. And so money itself, no, it's not the root of evil. Instead, as the Bible points out clearly, the love of money is the root of all evil. And I will tell you, Daniel, that many people can listen to that sentence, the love of money is the root of all evil, and they can immediately say to themselves, oh, well, I certainly don't love money, so therefore I know that I'm not worried about that. Well, what's interesting is these are very deceptive times. And I would suggest to your audience, and even I'm speaking to myself as well, and you, that many of us don't really realize how the love of money has infected us. This is part of what the book is about. It's trying to unpeel or unlayer this deception that surrounds money in the church. We don't fully realize how much we love money and how we worship money. It's something that that I think none of us are prepared even to go into, because it is such a devastating topic, because many of us are so attached to the possessions and to the wealth and to the things that we have in this temporal world.
That's absolutely true. But, you know, just like you pointed out, which I think really is the crux of the matter, yes, the Bible does say that it's the love of money that is the root of all evil. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians have taken that, omitted the word love, and just said money. And a lot of people have unfortunately thought that money in and of itself is evil, is bad, is wrong. Which, you know, as you pointed out, I mean, that does oftentimes come from our parents. What was the situation that we grew up in? What was the philosophy that our family had about money and so forth? But, you know, the Bible does not say that money in and of itself is evil. And talking about money is a good thing, because when we apply biblical principles and sound wisdom, it really is, it sets us free, so to speak. And so on that note, I want you to just describe, because you do it so well in your book, describe to us what money really is. And then, going one step further, what is the difference? Because there's different kinds of, you know, currencies, and I'll let you explain this. But, you know, what is money, and what are the different types of currencies?
Well, money itself, you know, certainly we view the dollar, we would say, oh, that's money. You know, we would see a dollar in our pocket. We say we work for money. Well, it's interesting, in the Old Testament, the word for money in the Hebrew is the same word as the word silver. It's something that has intrinsic value. Money is something that actually it's a medium of exchange, but it's also a store of value. That's the part that many people misunderstand. Certainly, we can take dollar bills that are pieces of paper, and we can trade them. You know, you have something that I want, and so I'll say, okay, I'll give you this green piece of paper. Why do you take it? Why do you accept it? Well, because you know that somebody else will accept it. So we know that it's a medium of exchange that's legally binding upon our economy and upon our commercial activity. But what many people don't understand what money really is that it's a store of value. It's supposed to hold value, and that is the area that we talk about in the book that has been completely and utterly destroyed. Every single empire has gone through the same decadent system or the same decadent cycle, and that is they begin with something like commodity money. Now, that's something where you and I end up creating a little city or a little village, and we realize we've got to create some sort of medium of exchange. You know, at first we're bartering, and then all of a sudden we start using corn or we start using shells or whatever's convenient. And then slowly, you know, that becomes very burdensome, and you're worried somebody's going to steal it. And so that moves into something called receipt money. And so receipt money is the place where we can take our shells or we can take our corn down to a, you know, to somebody who's actually going to house them, and then they give us a paper receipt in exchange. There's something backing up that receipt. So I can always take it down and say, I'm done with these paper receipts. I want my shells or I want my corn or whatever it is that's backing up the receipt. The next stage is the government over that empire, the government over that nation, says, look, you know, we need to regulate this because this is getting out of hand and governments don't feel like good governments until they begin to regulate. And they want to come in and regulate and regulate. So they come in and they say, listen, we'll create that piece of paper and we'll put our name on it. And then you just, you know, we'll back it up. Full faith and credit of the federal government. Insert the name of the government. And so then we have a currency that's backed up by something. The United States used to have money. Today it only has currency. The difference is money is backed up by something. Currency is not. So money, we did have money up until, you know, till the 1930s here in this nation. You could take your dollar bill down to the bank and turn it in for silver or gold. It was a silver certificate. You can find these in pawn shops now, part of our history. But the Federal Reserve, which is the nation's central bank, began to do what nations have always done, and that is to debauch the currency by printing more of it than we actually have to back it up. And therefore, you dilute the value of the currency. So what's happened is now we're moving into this area. Many people are now, you're hearing these phrases in the news. People are, you know, people who don't even pay attention to economics understand that the Federal Reserve is printing money out of thin air. People have heard that phrase, or they've heard that the Federal Reserve is printing money or too much money or, you know, all of this. What this leads to is something called hyperinflation. And that's a time, real basic, in one sentence, what is hyperinflation? It's whenever there is too much money in the system chasing too few goods. So that's the classical definition of what hyperinflation is. It's where we have too much money and the money is outpacing, the supply of money is outpacing the supply of goods. Therefore, the price of goods go up. And that's what many people are fearing in this environment as we see the national debt soaring, as we see the Federal Reserve pumping in fresh money, and as we see the economic recovery not really taking hold, we understand that we are on the precipice of something very devastating economically. Most of us can feel it in our gut. What we talk about in the book is how people can prepare for that. Not just individuals. I think churches have dropped the ball on this, Daniel. I mean, quite frankly, many churches did not see this economic crisis coming. And many of them today still have no clue what's going on, really. So they can't properly prepare their flock, and they cannot in any way, shape, or form properly prepare their community for what might be lying ahead. And that's a sad day whenever the church has to turn to the savvy people of the world with their hand out after supposedly being the prophet in their generation.
Hmm. Wow. That's really good. And what you're saying, talking about printing money out of thin air. Now, this isn't just printing money out of thin air in and of itself, but as you point out in your book, it's actually tied to a system of artificial demand called the petrodollar system. Now, can you please explain? Because I think this is something that's so misunderstood. Sometimes, you know, some of us have heard the word petrodollar. Others of us have not. What is the petrodollar? And can you tell us about the transition that was required to put us off of the gold standard and onto the petrodollar system?
Yeah, and I'll make this real, you know, layman's terms for those who, you know, maybe their head is swimming or they're thinking about economics and saying, this is way above me. You know what? This is not above you. In fact, you know, this information, I believe, is sorely lacking, as we mentioned, in the church, and it's sorely lacking in communities and in families. I believe this kind of information is the kind of information that can transform your finances. It can transform your church, because it truly provides some illumination to the crazy darkness that surrounds us. Let's just go back real quickly and say in 1913, okay, if you're looking at a timeline, the Federal Reserve was created. All the Federal Reserve is a bank. That's it. It's just a bank. So there's nothing, you know, crazy about it. It's just a bank. It's a really big bank. And its customers are not people walking in off the street to get a loan. They have very different customers. Their customer is the best customer any bank could have in the world, and that is governments. Now, why would a bank want a government as a customer? Well, the government can always tax its population, and so therefore the bank knows that their default risk is very, very low because the government can always go out and raise taxes. So in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act is passed. There is one more little act that got passed through Congress that same year. In fact, it occurred before the central bank of the Federal Reserve Act was passed, and that was the income tax. You see, the Federal Reserve, central banks, every country has one, and not a single one of them will start without guarantees that they can actually pickpocket the people living in the country. And that's exactly what the income tax is. When you think about it, you work and transact in this society, and yet before you get your check at the end of the week, the government has already taken the money out. Now, that's really absurd when you think about it. I mean, you know, we don't need to really worry about that and complain about that. There's not much we can change. But when you think throughout history, that's pretty bold for a government just to come up to you and take money out of your check. Historically speaking, that is really bold. But that's what's required for them to have the benefit of a central bank. Central bank has to know that it has guarantees that it can get paid. Now, the central bank, what it does is it creates the money, and it's supposed to have something backing it up. Mm-hmm. Up until the 1970s, we did have gold backing up the dollar. In fact, during World War II, we were the number one holder of all the gold in the world. I mean, 80% of the world's gold sat in our country. And the reason was we played World War II very smartly. As Europe beat up on itself and killed itself, we supplied weapons, we supplied oil, we supplied all types of different munitions, and we didn't take their currencies in many cases for payment. We took gold instead. So we drained them of their gold, and by the end of World War II, we were in a very good position. And therefore, in 1945, at the end of the war, the Bretton Woods Agreement, 1944, all of this happened. And so now what happens is the United States dollar is backed up by gold. And so all the currencies of the world then peg their currencies to the United States dollar. Okay. So what this did was, when you think about this, if you know that you can take your dollars and you can convert them to gold at any time. Or you can take your currency and convert it to dollars and then convert those dollars to gold at any time. Which currency do you want to hold? You might as well just hold the dollar, because the dollar is going to be able to be converted into gold much quicker without all the exchange rate complications. And so governments around the world believed that holding dollars was what they called, quote, as good as gold. So they chose to hold dollars because they knew they could turn them in at any time for gold. Well, the United States abused this privilege, and the way they abused it was so much demand around the world existed for dollars that they could print them and people would take them, and they could print more and people would hold them, so they never really had to deal with inflation. So we saw the time of the Vietnam War, this very first major, long, drawn-out battle that we went through in Vietnam. And then we saw the Great Society spending underneath LBJ, which was very expensive, and the introduction of Medicare, and all of these different programs, the War on Poverty. Well, as countries around the world saw what we were doing and debasing our currency, they said, look, you know, we don't agree with the economic policies of the United States. We want to turn in our dollars for gold. They were waiting for that moment, and it occurred, and so they turned in their money for gold. Well, by 1971, Britain and Germany, France, many of these other countries were demanding massive amounts of U.S. gold in exchange for their dollars. They didn't want to hold the dollars anymore. And finally, August 15th, 1971, it was during a Bonanza show, for those of you who remember the old Bonanza show. Mr. Richard Nixon, President Richard Nixon, comes on the TV, interrupts the Bonanza show, and tells the nation that the U.S. dollar is no longer backed up by gold. We can't afford it. Well, all of these countries around the world say, you've got to be kidding me. We can't turn in our dollars for gold. Many of them saw it coming, but many of them were shocked and surprised. So many just decided to get rid of their dollars. This caused even more problems. We had a massive recession during this time, and Nixon and Mr. Kissinger, who is Secretary of State, we've all heard of Henry Kissinger, these two came up with a fairly brilliant plan, and that was, we have to figure out a way to get other nations to demand our dollars the way they did underneath the old gold for dollars system. We got to figure this out. And so their plan was to approach Saudi Arabia, who was somewhat of an ally, and who was really building up their oil reserves. They weren't nearly like they are now, but they were really on the upward trend. They were discovering a lot of oil. They needed help getting oil out of the ground. We had good relationships with them on that front. And Kissinger went and spoke to the king of Saudi Arabia and said, look, we will protect your oil fields. These are of national interest to you. And Israel, who threatens you, they have a nuclear weapon. We all know it. And we're going to protect you from big bad Israel. And we're also going to provide you with weapons and munitions. And we might even put our own air base in here. And we'll help you extract your oil and all of this. And the Saudis were looking at Kissinger thinking, well, boy, well, what is he going to want? You know, he's probably going to want a bunch of money, or he's going to want us to do something we don't want to do. And the punchline was, Kissinger simply said, all we want you to do is price every single barrel of oil that you extract from the ground, price it in dollars. Well, at this point, the Saudis were thinking, you've got to be kidding me. This is it? I mean, there's nothing else. They're going to give us weapons. They're going to protect us from Israel. They're going to maybe even put a military base. They're going to give us airplanes, you know, fighter jets. All we have to do is price our oil in dollars? So what? We'll do that. You know, it wasn't no big deal. Didn't pick their pocket. It didn't break their leg, as Thomas Jefferson once said. So they were happy to do it. And what this did was exactly what Kissinger probably hoped it would. All the other nations surrounding Saudi Arabia, who also had oil fields, they heard about this deal that the Saudis got, and they wanted in. Hey, we want protection from Israel. We want weapons. We want fighter jets. We want you to put a base in our area. We want you to help us protect our oil fields. And so there we had it. The play was get every single barrel of oil coming up out of the ground in the Middle East to be priced in dollars. And when you do that, all of these nations around the world who need oil and buy it from the Middle East now have to take their currency and convert it to dollars. This requires them to have dollars. Therefore, they have to hold dollars. This gave the permission slip back to the United States to print lots of money. Because if you have lots of demand for your currency, then you can print lots of your currency. And the reason why this is so important is because of this real simple concept in economics that says the more money that's in the system, the higher things can be. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you and I, Daniel, we move to a little village and there's no money there. And we decide that we want to start a little economy and start a little village. And so let's say that we are going to use paper, and we cut up 10 pieces of paper, and that's our currency. Now, nothing in the village can cost 1,000,000 pieces of paper, you know, because we only have 10. But if we put 1,000,000 in, now all of a sudden something can cost 1,000,000. You can't raise prices in an economy without the supply of the money going up. So when people see their stock prices going up, they see their 401k investments going up, they see their housing values going up, they see their incomes going up, what's occurring? Does all of this have more value now? Is everything all of a sudden more valuable? Or is there more money in the system causing prices to rise? Well, the economist says it's obvious. More money in the system means higher prices. Now, this is why we say that the illusion of prosperity has been very damaging to the United States. Going to the church for a moment, the church sadly bought into this idea that this money was real, that this prosperity was real. You'll hear people today in Christian circles that make comments like this. Well, if we continue to have gay marriage or if we allow abortions to continue, God's going to destroy our economy. Well, that sounds real good on paper and that sounds really good in a book, but the fact of the matter is we destroyed our own economy, and our economy is already destroyed. That's the point. That's the punchline, I think, that people just don't grasp, that indeed the curse already is here. The curse came in the illusion of prosperity. We actually think that we're rich, but indeed we're actually very poor, because whenever people decide to stop taking the U.S. dollar, once this jig is up, we will find out that the money that we think we hold in our pocket is nothing but currency that has been printed out of thin air. And that's one of the major concerns I write about in the book, is what happens when the Middle East decides to move to a different currency for its oil. And, of course, we do dive into the book how that, more than likely, we can't know men's minds, and we can't know the inner workings of government without being there. But we do know that men move by incentive, and the incentive was certainly there to go into the Middle East to protect this petrodollar system, i.e. Iraq, and i.e. the 11-year war in Afghanistan, which is costing us, by the way, $2 billion a week and has done so for the last 11 years.
Yes. It is just amazing points when you begin to put some of the story together regarding the petrodollar system. I mean, it's really eye-opening to realize that regardless of our stance on Israel or our stance on the wars in the Middle East, our entire economy and everything that we believe that we have is actually hinging on the continuation of that oil over there being priced in U.S. dollars. Because the day, as you explain in your book, that that comes to an end, the illusion of our prosperity is following right along with it. And, you know, of course, it's always more complicated than a single sentence statement. But you have a really interesting point in your book when you said that the idea of a word note means debt. And when you say I have a car note, that means I have debt based on my ownership and possession of the car that I'm driving. And when you pull out a dollar bill from your wallet and you read Federal Reserve Note, it's the same principle that that bill is actually significant of the debt that you owe because of the possession of that bill. Can you expand on that a little bit more in light of what you said so far?
Yeah, it's a very bizarre process, but the way that the Federal Reserve works, and many people don't believe this when they first hear it. I remember being in economics class. I mean, we even learned this at the university level whenever I was there studying economics, and I remember the moment when we learned this, that there was kind of a gasp in the room as many people were in disbelief. It didn't sound like it's real, but it's totally real. The Federal Reserve gets an order to print currency from the United States Treasury. If the Congress, for example, decides, okay, we're going to pass this bill and we're going to spend this much money on war, well, they need money, and they don't have, they don't have a savings account. The government's, they're bankrupt. So what they have to do is they have to go and sell bonds. And when they sell bonds, Americans will buy them. Foreign governments will buy these bonds. And what they are is IOUs. And the government sells these bonds and says, yeah, we'll pay you back in 5, 10, 30 years, whatever. Just give us some money. And whenever they have a bond auction, whatever they don't sell, the Federal Reserve, in its bylaws, it's required to be the lender of last resort. So if they're trying to auction off, let's say, $500 million in bonds, and they only sell $200 million in bonds at the auction, the Federal Reserve is obligated by law to fund the rest of that auction. So they have to print the money and then provide it to the government. Well, where does the Fed get the money? That's the big question. We know where the other people got the money. They got the money from the general economy. They got it from their savings account. They got it from their government coffers, wherever they got it. But where does the Fed get the money from? Well, the Fed doesn't have a savings account either. In fact, all they have is the ability to print money. So they literally will print money out of thin air and then buy these bonds, and then they hold the bonds. What's interesting about the Federal Reserve is not only do they monetize this debt by buying the bonds with printed money out of thin air, but they also set the interest rates that they're going to be paid back. So, when you hear the Federal Reserve setting interest rates or setting interest rate targets and they have these meetings, well, they're setting their own interest rates. I mean, this is the most rigged system that you could ever imagine. The bank itself sets its own interest rates that it's going to be paid back. Now, one of the concerns is about this is that when you look at a dollar bill, as you pointed out, it says at the very top, Federal Reserve note. So it tells you instantly, this piece of paper is a loan. It's a loan. So in essence, when you go work and you work at a job or whatever you're doing and you get paid in these dollar bills, well, you're getting paid with a Federal Reserve note. And what that means is the Federal Reserve owns that piece of paper. It's theirs. They put their name on it. And it's a loan by them to the government and then to you in the end. So you're carrying around this dollar bill, and what's interesting about it is, this is probably the most bizarre thing in the world that I've ever heard.
Huh.
And that is, this dollar bill was printed by the Federal Reserve, and then it has to be paid back with interest. But the interest doesn't exist. So if the Federal Reserve loans the government, let's say that $200 billion or $300 billion, or million dollars that they need to borrow, the government says, thank you. But then the Federal Reserve says, no problem, pay that back to us with interest. Well, where does that interest come from? Who makes the interest? Who prints the money that's paid as interest? That's the kicker. There is no money for interest. So in essence, we have this game of musical chairs in the U.S. economy where all that exists is the principal, but interest is owed. And so, therefore, the principal has to be used to pay for both the principal and the interest. Therefore, you have to have foreclosures. You have to have bankruptcy. They are inherent in the system. It's the way the system has been rigged. There have to be losers because there's not enough money to go around to pay for all the interest. These things desperately need to be understood by people of faith, because the Bible tells us that we are to be as wise as serpents and as gentle as doves. And you cannot be as wise as a serpent in this generation and not understand how Satan has totally pulled the wool over the American people's eyes with money. It's an unbelievable, astonishing story.
It is unbelievable. As a matter of fact, it's just so ridiculous. It makes you sick to your stomach. Let me, before we, because we have about 10 minutes, and then we're going to go to break. Before we do that, can you explain to our audience how the Fed, meaning the Federal Reserve, one, exists as an entity that is not federal? It is not a government institution. It's a private bank. Explain how it exists that way. And two, how they can literally increase and decrease the money supply.
Well, you know, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, it is not, as you mentioned, a part of the federal government. The government has its tentacles in the central bank. It does have some, you know, in some ways it's a quasi-government agency. In some ways. However, it is extremely autonomous, and that's part of the reason why it still exists, is because it's autonomous. But overall, the Federal Reserve is, again, it's a leech upon the economy because, and we can say that with all conviction, because in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, mm-hmm. it says that Congress is the only institution that has the permission to coin money. You know, what did our founders know about central banks? Well, they fled the Bank of England whenever they left the mother country. They knew that the Bank of England, they were running more from the Bank of England than they were the Church of England. I know most of the stories talk about the Pilgrims and the Church of England and the persecution. Well, you know, if you notice what we did when we came over here, it was much more about money than it was about religious freedom. I mean, it was much more about money. And, of course, what we tried to do is we tried to get away from the taxes. We tried to get away from the economic oversight of the Bank of England. And one of the things that our founders were absolutely absolute about was the fact that we would not have a fiat currency as they did in England. And so they were adamant that we would only use silver, gold, and coined money. In fact, in 1792, the Currency Act was passed and signed by George Washington, and he said that any man who ever, ever, ever created a paper money that was not backed up by anything should be hanged. I mean, it was a death penalty, and they were serious about this. They did not want us to be where we are today. And what's so ironic is Mr. George Washington's face graces the front of the Federal Reserve note, the $1 bill. Of course, he would have had someone hanged for even making that or printing it. So it does violate Article 1, Section 8 in the Constitution, and so we can say without any kind of uncertainty that the Federal Reserve is a leech. It's an unnecessary organism that exists within our economy, and it serves to redistribute wealth from the poor, from the working class, to the upper class, to the wealthy. It's exactly what it's designed to do, and that's exactly what it's achieving. In fact, if you look at a lot of the money that came from the Federal Reserve and the bailout, it went straight to the banks.
Yes.
People know this. They're waking up. They're realizing this is a sham. Something's going on, and they realize something has to be done. As believers, we know that men are going to sin. We know mm-hmm. that sin is the problem and Christ is the answer. So we present Christ as the answer. We don't go out and hold picket signs and try to change the world. Instead, what we do is we try to turn the world upside down through our testimony and through our public speech and public testimony, and also our character, showing mm-hmm. people through our character and through our actions Christ, and making mm-hmm. him seen through that.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Yes, and so, I mean, that's exactly what you just said right there. A lot of problems with our monetary policy and our debt issue really is rooted in our central banking system, which comes through the Federal Reserve. I mean, that is the key element of everything that we're experiencing now. And, the other thing that you pointed out in your book that just blew my mind is that, through policy writing with the stroke of a pen, the Fed, and use that as a term for the Federal Reserve, can, with interest rates, actually manipulate how much money is in the system, and so they can purposefully take our economy through booms and busts with policy.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about the banks right now, everyone's complaining about low interest rates. And for those, in the audience who have money in a bank or they have money in a CD and they're looking at these pathetic rates, they have the Federal Reserve to thank. But remember, what central banks do. The way that central banks win is when they get you to borrow a bunch of money. I mean, think about the banks. If you're a banker, what do you want? I mean, you want people to borrow lots and lots and lots and lots of money. What's one good way to do that? Well, lower interest rates, right? And so you lower interest rates, and then the governments, they borrow money. Well, what happens is then you turn around, and then you hike the rates after they've borrowed a bunch. And then guess what? You own them. Own their country. And that's exactly what the founders were saying. Do not let these private banks come in and loan money to you and drop the interest rates to absurd levels and then turn around and then own you in the end. And that's exactly what the Federal Reserve is doing right now. It's policies. They have ultra-low interest rates. They have kept rates low unbelievable amounts of time, and it's a shame. By doing so, it hides the fact that we have problems. When they raise rates, our government is not going to be able to afford the interest on the debt, let alone the debt. Forget the principal payment. The interest on that print. Can you imagine the interest payment on a $16 trillion debt when it's 8%, 9%? I mean, that's going to be more than that's going to be more than almost all of our government spending combined. So yeah. The Federal Reserve knows what it's doing. It's going to transfer most of the wealth in this country to itself. And that's what central banks have always done. That's what, it's not a surprise. It's not something that should shock us. But we need to be prepared for it. And we need to be doing things in our own families' lives and our own finances to prepare for this, because history repeats itself, and those who don't learn from it are, they're doomed to repeat it.
Yes, it's just such a spectacular. I mean, in your book, you went ahead and outlined a history of nations that have been through the cycle of the fiat system in place. And how they have gone, printed a whole bunch of money, and they have gone into hyperinflation, and everything collapses. The whole system collapses in on itself, and it happened over and over, and it keeps on repeating. And even a couple of quotes that said by others, there's multiple ways to overrun a country. One is with guns and military, and two is with debt.
Absolutely.
How do you feel about the idea of taking over a nation by indebting them?
I mean, it's in complete opposition to the Word of God. The Bible tells us that a borrower is a slave to the lender. It never tells us that debt is a sin, but it does say that debt is really dumb, and we shouldn't get ourselves entangled in it. But
yeah,
one of the things about debt in itself is it's so ironic with a nation who prides itself on being the land of the free and the home of the brave and liberty and all of this. But in fact, they're slaves. I mean, they're enslaved to the banks. They're enslaved to the central bank. You know, when I say they, I'm talking about me. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about us. Our children. Mm-hmm. Our children are indebted to this central bank. I mean, it's an absolute travesty. You know what's even worse? Is you actually, on this last presidential debate, you didn't hear the Federal Reserve, the phrase, ever brought up during the debates. Well, they don't ever bring that stuff up. They don't want to talk about that. You don't bring that stuff up. You know, that's the stuff you talk about if you want to, you know, all of a sudden die from a heart attack, you know, in a back room somewhere mysteriously. You don't bring that stuff up. You leave it alone. You talk about other things. You focus on other things, and that's the thing that we didn't see in the debates at all. Everybody was either for Obama or for Romney, and neither one of them would even dare utter the phrase Federal Reserve because they know that they can't do anything about it. So, and they also know that if they don't have a Federal Reserve, they have to raise taxes. If you can't borrow from the Fed, you got to borrow from somebody. And I don't think you and I really want to pony up money for them to go fight all these endless wars. So they just conveniently use the Fed to do that as their checkbook.
And down the rabbit hole we go. All right, if you're listening, you've been listening to Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall. Now, we've been talking with our special guest, Jerry Robinson. We've been learning a ton of information. He's explained to us how the money is not the root of all evil. It's the love of money. However, money really is not just to be understood as the fiat certificate that we carry in our wallets. One of the definitions of money is that it has a store of value. That's very important for us to understand because many of us walk around with this false impression that if we have, you know, $1,000 in our wallet, that $1,000 today is going to be $1,000 tomorrow. It's not. It's a store of it really is a store of money. And really, in the second hour, we're going to get more into some of the strategies that Jerry teaches in order to curb this fact of our society, in order to actually rise above it, be outstanding stewards, and come out of it winning. But we have to understand money, we think when we see that currency, that's not true. He's also explained to us the importance of understanding the petrodollar system. And that's our exit music. So anyway, we're going to be back in a few minutes, and we're going to continue talking about money. We're going to continue talking about all of these important issues that Jerry has addressed in his book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation. Don't miss us when we come right back. Come on, clap your hands and say, he's coming in.
Welcome to the all-new CBN Gospel from the Christian Broadcasting Network on CBN.com.
We want to speak life over you today. Every person listening, we want you to understand that no matter where you've been or where you might currently find yourself, it's not over. When God is in it, there is no limit. New Breed.
It's not over.
Not finished.
Not finished.
It's not the end yet.
All right. Well, we are back with Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall. Now, we've been talking with our guest, Jerry Robinson, who's doing an absolute fantastic job explaining so many things to us. His book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation, Revised and Expanded. His website, www.ftmdaily.com, great resource, so much information about money, definitions, strategies for navigating this mess that we are in this nation, all Christ-centered. So, Jerry.
Yes.
We are back, and now, man, there's so much to talk about. It's really kind of hard to fit it all in there. But all that we've been talking about, one of the central events that we're looking forward to in this country, going to affect a lot of things across the board, is Obamacare. As an economist and as someone that has done their homework, I really want to get your thoughts on Obamacare, what its economic impact is going to be as you foresee it.
Well, they've, you know, the other side of the aisle has done a lot to demonize Obamacare. In general, Republican Party has done all it can to demonize Obamacare and what it's going to mean. However, as an economist, as I look out and see the broken healthcare system here in America, something has to be done. I haven't seen the Republicans put forth anything as comprehensive as Obamacare. Obviously, it flies in the face of free market principles. Many people would say, well, it's socialized medicine. But, you know, to those who say that, they must realize that practically everything in this country has become socialized. So to omit health care from the socialization scheme just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, to be intellectually honest and consistent. But, you know, to be very direct about the Obamacare, I am actually, as an economist, as somebody who has been in the financial services industry, I do understand how it's going to benefit many insurance companies. I also see how it's going to benefit many hospitals. But I can also see how it's going to harm many business owners. And so I am somewhat aloof on this topic. It's not something that I hold a very strong opinion about. I believe that most people who have attempted to demonize it have done so without doing their homework. But I believe those who applaud it may be overlooking some of the more sinister things in the bill that could, be damaging to the overall economy. However, all that being said, it still, even despite it being a very large bill and a very expensive bill and a very expensive thing to do, it's still a drop in the bucket compared to much of the other spending that we spend, here in this country. So it is big. It is looming. But there are many other areas, I believe, that are much more devastating initially than a perceived problem with Obamacare costing the country too much.
Okay. Thank you. By the way, if you're listening and you'd like to ask our guest a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 718-766-4160. Again, that's 718-766-4160. If you're listening to this live program and you wanted to communicate something with us, please feel free to call in. Okay. Now, Jerry, the next thing on my notes that I wanted to talk with you about, because I saw that you spent some time addressing it even in one of your own radio programs, was QE3. And I don't think that a lot of people understand what this is. Personally, I haven't really done much homework into what this is, what it means. Can you spend some time telling us about QE, maybe QE2 as a predecessor to QE3 and what is behind all of this?
Well, you can imagine somebody, imagine a very sick person who falls ill and goes to the hospital. And, you know, the doctor comes out, and, you know, those things they rub together and shock the patient with, you know. In essence, this is shock therapy. This is a dying man on a gurney, and these are the final desperate attempts to get an economy back going again. We have never, in fact, you can go through history, economically speaking, and go through and try to find an economy that has experienced the type of Herculean type of monetary intervention that we have, you won't find it. Mm. This is what scares many economists and many financial observers and investors, for that matter. And that's why many people are choosing to purchase gold and silver, is because they understand that the Federal Reserve is pumping money in over and over and over, and that's exactly what these quantitative easing programs are. QE3 stands for quantitative easing. It's mm-hmm. just another word for money printing. So they say, we're going to print X amount of dollars, and we're just going to provide it to, you know, this. We're going to buy this, or we're going to buy that. We're going to buy bonds, or we're going to buy, you know, mortgage-backed securities, whatever, you know, like whatever they decide to do. And what that does is it's supposed to prop up those particular interest rates, bring them down, and provide a liquidity to different markets. Well, you know, it's not working. I mean, I think that's the part that most people fully comprehend, is that no one would look at our economy right now and say that it's healthy. Most of us know that the economy is not healthy, but at the same time, there have been so many Band-Aids put on the economy that we can't quite tell exactly how bad it is. I think that's part of the problem with the Federal Reserve and all this quantitative easing. You know, when you go to business school, you spend some time in college and or even high school, and you learn about the business cycle, about how things kind of go and in a cycle. Well, you know, the Federal Reserve and the central bank itself has intervened so much in the economic cycle that guys like me, I mean, the economists of the world, we can't even tell exactly where we are in the cycle. We have no clue. Are we in the recovery? Are we in the trough? Are we in the – well, we're certainly not at the peak. If we're at the peak, we're in trouble. And so, you know, where are we at in the business cycle? Well, nobody knows, because it's been so altered. It's been so tampered with. And so this has to be allowed to run its course. The way that you solve this problem – is, you know, obviously you get rid of the Federal Reserve, that would be a great start. But mm-hmm. you know, one of the easiest things to do is to raise interest rates. Raise interest rates now and develop some other form of energy that doesn't make us so dependent upon, you know, foreign countries for our oil supplies. Convert to natural gas. I mean, there's so many different things that the government could be doing, but instead they're bickering about, you know, what happened in Benghazi. I mean, they're bickering about all of these things that they can't change when there are so many things that they can change, but they're not mm-hmm. touching them. That is what alarms investors, economists around the world, is the fact that the United States government has many things that it can change, and it won't even discuss them. Now, you know, that leads to a brick wall eventually. And so that's where we believe we're heading. It's an old saying by Winston Churchill, which is pretty smart. He said, Americans are really good at doing the right thing after they have exhausted all other options. And that's really where America is now. We're going to figure this out, but it won't be early. It'll be after a lot of problems and a lot of pain have pushed us to that solution.
Wow. And this kind of segues, and I want to have you talk about the Social Security crisis that we're facing, because what you just could kind of like, you know, spearheads right into that idea. I believe you dedicated an entire chapter to this issue. What is this crisis? And How is this reflected in terms of national debt and unfunded liability? That's another thing. You know, a lot of people, I'll rephrase that question, but, you know, a lot of people, they look at this $15.5 trillion debt and say, wow, you know, we're really in debt. This is really bad. But the real unfunded liability debt right now is close to $120 trillion, and that's tied into a lot of this Social Security crisis. So can you spend a little bit of time talking about this aspect of what our economy is hinging on?
Yeah, absolutely. And just a couple of points about that before we talk about Social Security was you brought up the $120 trillion. What's interesting is all that money is owed for, you know, future obligations. Well, you know, if you took all the money in the world and you pulled it together, you wouldn't even have $120 trillion. I'm not talking about dollar. I'm talking about every currency in the world and converted it to dollars. There's not $120 trillion in the world. So how are you going to pay that off? The other thing is that if you look at the U.S. economy, this is what really freaks people out, is you tell them there is less than $3 trillion in the U.S. economy. Well, how can you have a $16.5 trillion debt if you only have $3.5 trillion? You know, if, for example, President Barack Obama goes to bed tonight and he has a dream where he is supposed to pay off the national debt, he couldn't do it. There's not enough money in the economy to pay off the $16.5 trillion. He can't, you know, pay off the debt and then call Dave Ramsey and scream how he's debt-free. He doesn't have that option. We're not able to pay off the debt. And the problem is let's say that we did pay off the debt. We still have to pay off the interest on the debt. And that's the problem that this country faces, is that there's just not enough money to even take care of these things. Social Security, to your question, Social Security was a grand idea. I mean, you know, it was a noble idea. You know, take care of the elderly, take care of the widow, take care of those who are nearing quite frankly death. They're not able to work anymore, and they need help. I mean, that was a very noble idea. It was also a very Christian idea, which, you know, as we look at the church is the one who is called to take care of the widows and the orphans. And, you know, it's interesting how we've just kind of lopped that onto the government and want them to take care of it whenever we're the ones who were mandated to do that. But, you know, and especially even our own, and many churches don't even take care of their own widows and orphans. You know, they simply bounce that off onto the government. Well, the government, you know, came up with a Social Security plan, and you can debate whether it was good or whether it was not, but I think it was a noble thing. The problem was the demographics and the age just didn't work out when they started, you know, all the actuaries. They didn't realize that people would be living as long as they do now. So we have this really antiquated system that says you can start taking, you know, a very large amount of money. No one would, you know, people who receive it don't view it as large. But when you go back to the original conception of Social Security, it's a fairly large amount to be paying out on a monthly basis from the government, from current workers. And right now we have, you know, three or four workers for every retiree. It's going to get worse as we go forward in time. So, you know, when it was first initiated, you know, it was much, much higher. The ratio was much more in favor of the retiree and the worker. So, you know, where we are now is a very antiquated system that needs a full revision. It needs a hard reset. We need to reboot this system and bring it up to date with medical advances, medical technologies, because people are living much, much longer, but they still believe that they are, you know, allowed to retire at 65, and they are, because the government has told them that they can't. The government took their money through FICA taxes for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and then for the government to then turn around and say, well, we can't pay you, that would be absurd and be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So the money is owed to people. People paid for that. So it does kind of bother me when people call those entitlements in a wrong way. But people paid for that, and they should receive their money back. The problem is that the politicians are scared to death to touch that topic because their only incentive is reelection. What they need to do is they need to look at younger workers and say, look, sorry, you know, we can't afford this anymore. You're going to have to, you're going to stop paying for it, but you're also going to stop getting it. You need to come up with your own plan. It would be great if the government would get out of the retirement business. They don't really belong here, and that's proven by the fact that, you know, we don't have enough money to take care of what we promised. So the government is certainly going to default on Social Security. There is no doubt in my mind that by 20, you know, in fact, when I wrote the first book, Daniel,
mm-hmm.
I called it the 2040 crisis. That's whenever Social Security would be completely bankrupt. Well, when I wrote this new book, it was 2037. And then when the book went to press, the new number was 2036. Just recently I was reading, and now the number is 2033. So by the year 2033, 7 years have already been shaved off of that forecast now. That's when Social Security is planned to be bankrupt. So when that's bankrupt, I mean, that's a big, big problem. And so the government, again, is not addressing it. They're not talking about it. They're not focusing on it. They're instead focusing upon things that they can't change. And, again, why? Because their only incentive is reelection. That's their only incentive. Politicians
wow.
in Washington, congressmen, they can go to Washington and they can do their, you know, they can serve for as long as they possibly can. And then when they get out, they typically got a golden parachute, they've got, you know, lifetime pension, lifetime health care in many cases. And then on top of that, and you know, they don't have to deal with Social Security. They don't have to deal with Medicare. You know, one of the ways you could fix Social Security real quickly is make sure the congressman had to receive it. Well, congressmen would quickly solve Social Security if they were going to have to receive it. You know, they don't have to receive it. They get a different kind of government pension. And that's really not the way it should be. But that's the way that it is. So, again, the politicians don't have any incentive to fix this stuff. They just have an incentive to get reelected. And the way you get reelected is you promise more goodies to the folks, and that's how you get reelected. So politicians are not going to make those hard choices. That's why we wrote this book. That's why, you know, it's incumbent upon me and you and believers in Christ to take responsibility for our own financial lives, become good stewards, and not put any hope, faith, and trust in this bankrupt government, because they're not going to have enough money to take care of you and me and everybody else in this country. We're going to have to figure out how to do that on our own. And I believe the Bible has great precepts and wisdom on how we can do that.
Amen. At this point, Jerry, you've talked about so much, and this is one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on. Is that you know, a lot of people they just don't know these things because it's not something that you think about. You know, you don't really think about where your next meal is coming from when Walmart's open 24/7. You don't think about what that dollar you're carrying really is when it works and you can still spend it. But looking forward and preparing to be good stewards in a time of economic upheaval, a lot of these topics really come to the surface and become extremely important. And that's why in this next part of the show, what I really want to do is begin to get into some of the strategies that you teach to allow people to navigate the economic crisis on this side of it, and then being placed in a position where they'll be ready to navigate should an economic collapse or the failure of the dollar, you know, happen within a couple years or tomorrow, whatever. Let's start here. Consumption. You talk about something called the consumption trap. What is that, and how do you see people being able to be liberated from that?
Well, the consumption trap is really just something that, you know, each of us have fallen into by way of living in this nation. You know, we are told through the collaboration of merchants and financial institutions and advertisers that we have to live a certain life. We are never really given the option whether to outsource our production or to actually produce on our own. When you think about who actually makes money today, aside from the financial industry, which really doesn't produce anything, they do produce some value in some ways, but for the most part, they're not really producing anything. We wouldn't think of a stockbroker as a manufacturer of anything. He doesn't produce anything. The government doesn't produce anything. Therefore, they're a dead weight as well. So, who makes the real money? Well, aside from people who can print money out of thin air and earn money off interest, the predominant wealthy are those who produce. They create things. Take a look around your house. In fact, anyone who's listening to this program now or later, whenever it's recorded, just do me a favor and take a look all around you for a moment. Look around your, wherever you're sitting. Just observe everything around you and find something that you produced. Find something that you made. What we'll discover is that unless you're a homemaker or a crafty type of person, most of us don't really make anything. In fact, what we've been taught is that we have to go and buy everything that we need from the producers. That's a good deal for the producers, isn't it? Because now they've created demand for their goods. Now, when you have a job, who do you work for? Well, you work for people who produce. You work for the producer. So the producer then pays you money, and then you turn right back around and give it back to him. This is a very obvious scam, but it's really not a scam because the people are willing to do it. People are willing to outsource all of their production. And in fact, if you think about the American dream, you think about what people really want in America, they have really believed the lie that financial success is outsourcing all of your production. You don't do your nails, you don't do your own hair, you don't make your own clothes, you don't wash your own car, you don't mow your own lawn, you don't clean your own dishes, you outsource everything. You don't take care of your own kids. Everybody does something for you. We think that is the pinnacle of financial success. Well, no wonder so many of us are on the treadmill, working at jobs we hate because we have to get enough money to pay off these producers because we believe we have to outsource all of our production. It's a brilliant scam. I mean, you got to give it credit. But for people who are listening to this, I would encourage you to think: what are you producing? What are you producing? What kind of value are you creating for society? What kind of value are you creating? Value creators are wealth creators. That's really simple. Value creation equals wealth creation. Producers make money, and they make money from consumers. So most Americans, whether they would want to admit it or not, do not create any value, and they consume. They don't produce, and they don't create value. You know what? I've been there. I know exactly what that feels like, and it's okay when you're there. But awareness is the very first step. Okay, I don't create value. I only consume. What do I need to do? Well, we need to think about what we can produce. How can we begin to create value for those around us? Daniel, you're creating value. You're creating value with this radio show. You're creating value through your ministry. You're creating value through your books. You're creating value. And value attracts money, right? No one ever pays for anything that they don't believe they're going to receive value for. No one walks into a Walmart and says, oh, I have to buy this shirt. Well, they buy it because they believe it's going to give them value. Everything we buy because it brings us some sort of value. Therefore, if you're not creating any value, then you're not going to receive any money. The only reason that an employer pays you is because he believes that you're bringing value to the company. And you're not really creating value. You're helping him create value. You see, he's the one who is creating the value, and he's leveraging you and through your work and through your employment to help him create value. And he pays you pennies on the dollar what he earns. Now, no one pays an employee what he is really worth. They would go out of business if that was the case. If a business owner makes $50 an hour by having you work, then he's not going to pay you $50 an hour. He's going to pay you $10. Most employers pay you about 20%, some pay 10% of what they actually earn from you. And so what many people don't realize is that they are other people's leverage. They are being leveraged by the producers. The producers, number one, send them ads, they send them commercials, they send them TV ads, they send them billboards and say, you've got to buy this, you've got to buy that. And then on top of that, they employ them. And by employing them, they are also leveraging them. They're leveraging their labor and they're leveraging their money. So this is the trap that many of us fall into. We don't realize it because we don't know any different. This is just how it is. You grow up, you go to school, you get a job, you try to keep that job. You try not to lose that job. But many of us don't realize that there is such a better way, and there's a much more secure way, and the secure way is to create value. And, of course, there's many ways to do that.
And just to kind of piggyback off of what you just said, because I believe that that is so key. So key to the way that we need to approach life. And it's not about what we can get out of this world. It's really about how can we employ every God-given gift that I have to make a difference in this world. That mentality creates value. The greatest value that I believe any person will attain is when they purpose to fully develop and mature in their areas of gifting. There's a lot of people chase careers that have nothing to do with what they're good at simply because they think it's going to make them the most money and whatever. Whatever reason, it was what they went to school for. That is not creating value. That's actually aborting the value that your life holds. And so, listeners, what Jerry's saying is so true. Take that. Think like a value creator. Think like a producer. And also, think, wow, am I as simple as it's doing what I was created to do? And if I am I doing what I was created to do and maturing in it and not just staying stagnant? Stagnation is one of the greatest crucifiers of true potential in this world. You cannot, as a person, stagnate in your gifting, in your calling, and in your production. We, as the body of Christ, need to stop settling. I think this leads right into this idea that the Bible says the wealth of the wicked is stored up for the just. As we tap into things that you're talking about, I believe that God literally, spiritually directs the provision towards his people in your own life. you have seen, because I know you, quite a bit of financial success. And so why don't you talk about that and also kind of like tie in some of the practical strategies like the PACE investment strategy and the five levels of financial freedom that you talk about.
Well, for the majority of people listening, you pointed out a great thing when you said that many times that we sacrifice our potential for a job or for a career or, something that we think that we want, but in essence it's in somewhat conflict with what we've been called to do. That's another reason why we talk about what we talk about. When you create value, when you do these things, it provides you a certain freedom that then translates into you being able to do the things that God's called you to do. I can't tell you how many churches, we speak at a lot of churches, we talk to people, we have a Building True Wealth Financial Seminar where we talk about all of these things and then a lot more when we go into somebody's church. And I can't tell you how many churches I've been in where I see people sitting in the pews, listening to me, writing voraciously, and then coming up afterwards and telling me, I'm in a job that I hate, and I was supposed to be a missionary, and I know, or I was supposed to start this ministry, or I was supposed to help this guy get his ministry. I don't have time. Just all of these aborted dreams, you know, the people have that have suffered because of the consumption trap. You know, what's funny about it, it's not funny, it's ironic. These people have credit card payments, they have new cars, they have big screen TVs, they have all these trappings, and yet they're concerned and upset that their dreams have been aborted. And what's unwittingly happened to them, and they don't realize it, but what's happened to them is they have been co-opted by the producers. The producers have basically turned them into, you know, they're, you know, for lack of a better word, slaves. They've turned them into their slaves who now, you know, will purchase everything that they put out, will think that they have to have those things to have a better self-image or better self-esteem. And so that right there is the very first thing that you have to wake up to. None of this makes sense unless you understand how that game has been played on you and that the joke is on you. It's on me. So we have to wake up to that. Once we wake up to that, the next step after awareness is to say, okay, how am I going to begin creating value? And one of the things that I did, Daniel, early on, was I learned a skill that nobody really knew, that nobody really wanted to do, and that was repairing appliances. It was one of those things that my father had taught me, and I learned how to repair appliances, and I immediately went out and started my own business. And before I knew it, I had people working for me, and we were creating value. Somebody has a broken refrigerator, right? They have pain. When you find somebody in pain, they are willing to pay you for the solution. That's no matter where you are, no matter what country you're in, no matter what language you speak, people pay to get rid of pain. And when your stuff is de-thawing in the freezer, you are in pain, and you will pay somebody to fix that. So the higher the pain level, the higher the paycheck, if that makes any sense. The, the more pain that this, you know, that's why doctors make so much money. These people have real pain, you know, so they pay a lot of money. You have to find the pain. Think about everything around you. Where is the pain, and how can you solve it? If you start solving pain, money will never be an object that you'll ever have to worry about. And what we do here at our organization is we teach the idea or the philosophy of creating multiple streams of income. This is so vital because the average American family today, mother, father, child, the average American family has three streams of income. Mommy, daddy are both working, and there's probably a CD that's showing off a little bit of interest. That's it. Mommy gets you know, downsized, daddy loses his job, the family's in turmoil, they're one paycheck away from foreclosure. So they're living in very, you know, the divorce rate's up high, you know, there's a lot of tension, a lot of stress. It's all about this. Well, what if you could have four or five or six or seven or eight or nine income streams? Well, why can't you? Of course you can. In fact, we talk about on our website the 22 streams of income that anyone can start. Whether you have time or whether you have money, income streams can be started. Jennifer and I don't say this to boast at all, but it's to show you that it's possible. Because I'm not, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer by any means, but I'm willing to turn the TV off and actually get busy and work hard. And we've created 18 streams of income in our life. That means that if one of them or two of them or four of them or eight of them disappear, it doesn't matter. So I'm not dependent upon one stream. And we teach people that's so vital. And it's a very different way of thinking because most people tend to think of job, employer, and when they lose that job, they find another employer. That's totally fine. Nothing wrong with having a job. But if you have a job, you don't want that to be your only stream of income. You want to have more streams of income. You don't have more streams of income because you love money. You don't have more streams of income because you want to fill your life up with money and fill up your barns and with plenty and then reject God. You do it because you know that that is the only way that you can experience physical freedom in this world. Spiritual freedom comes through Christ. But you know, there's a lot of people who are in bondage who belong to Christ. They're in bondage physically. They're working at a job that they have to work at because they have to pay the bills. They have way too much debt hanging over their heads. They're in bondage to that. The Bible tells us that a borrower is a slave to the lender. You can be free in Christ and a slave to the lender at the same time. So it's the key to breaking free physically in this physical world. And our physical life is a very important thing to God. He wants to see us free there as well. So that's what we teach people, multiple streams of income. Now, you mentioned the PACE investment philosophy. I'll talk about that just for just a second because there's plenty of information on our website. Our website, by the way, for people who want to learn all about this stuff, is F as in Frank, T as in Tom, M as in Mary, FTMDaily.com. That stands for Follow the Money Daily.com. And we also have created something called the PACE investment philosophy. When times of hyperinflation occur, when the dollar is going down, when there's too many dollars in existence, when the central bank is flooding the economy with too many dollars, things that cannot be printed tend to go up. So financial instruments, derivatives, stocks, bonds, those things become very calamitous and tumultuous. But things that can't be printed by banks or financial institutions include things like precious metals. You can't print gold and silver. You can't create more of it. You have to go find it. Agriculture and commodities. You know, these things you can't print. They tend to go up when a lot of money goes into the system. And E stands for energy. So you have P, precious metals, A, agriculture, C, commodities, and E, standing for energy. These are the four areas that we believe have always done well in the past during hyperinflation and will continue to thrive as we go forward. So we're big believers in gold and silver. We're big believers in agricultural commodities, cotton, sugar, all of these, you know, these kind of boring things that do very well, energy, natural gas, uranium, things like that that we like and that we actually hold in our own investment portfolio that people can actually follow. We have a model portfolio. Then finally, the five levels of financial freedom. In essence, that's the big enchilada. It's a free course that we have on our website that you can go through, beginning at level one, and then level two, and then level three. It's a journey towards financial freedom, and it's put in a proper order. We've based it completely on what we believe to be a biblical model for financial planning. It involves laying a foundation. It involves creating a surplus of savings. It involves spreading out your investment across a diversified pool of assets. And it also encourages some speculation, but only after you've laid that foundation and you can afford to lose money. Some people like to trade stocks. Some people like to flip houses. Nothing wrong with all that stuff. But if you're trying to do that because you don't have any money, you're gonna hurt yourself. So you always want to lay a foundation before you go to speculate. And so that's what the five levels of financial freedom are. They are a step-by-step guide to those who want to get ahead financially and break free, financially speaking. It's their roadmap to financial success, and it's the exact roadmap that my wife and I used to achieve what we've achieved.
And I think it's safe to say that on a personal level, while we can, and doing like what we're doing here, we're exposing the system. But on a personal level, when it comes to what does it mean for me that the dollar has so much debt on it, it is basically doomed at some point in the future to collapse, that our nation is bankrupt. What can I do personally? Using some of these tools that you have just described really is a viable solution for us. And a lot of people while they have heard of gold and silver investing, and this is what I love about your system, a lot of people haven't thought of sugar and cotton and natural gas, holding these things and ownership over them as additional countermeasures against a collapsing financial system. And so I really appreciate that you guys have put this together, that you have organized it and explained it in the way that you have, because it helps. It helps us. It gives us something to proactively do in light of the information that I believe God wants us to know. Because how can he deliver us from a problem we don't even believe exists?
So true.
But here now, I wanted to also go into a couple more things based on the precious metals, because there's some other avenues that haven't been talked about as much, but I know that you have referenced them and you have knowledge of them. So I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on diamonds and palladium?
I'm a fan of both. Palladium, in particular, is in an interesting place right now and should probably be watched closely, but there's no buy signal that we see currently on palladium. But I do like palladium for the sheer fact that it's used in practically every automobile in the world because of the catalytic converter. They move from platinum to palladium, and palladium's going up in value. Most of the palladium that's mined, it comes out of South Africa, some out of Russia. It's an interesting metal. We provide an update on our website every single week called the Precious Metals Market Update, and we cover all four precious metals: gold, silver, palladium, and platinum. And our latest forecast on palladium is just kind of a hold for those who currently own it. Hold it for those who are looking to take a new position. It's probably not a good time yet. As far as diamonds go, diamonds are probably the most easy and most transportable form of wealth in the world. It's extremely private. You can carry out a multi-million dollar portfolio out of this country in your shirt pocket. You can't do that with gold. You know, gold, you know, it's very heavy. It's very cumbersome to carry around. But the diamonds, you know, that's how many of the Jews escaped with their wealth in Nazi Germany, is they actually escaped, and they would take the diamond and they would put it on their wife's, you know, ring finger, and they were allowed to leave with their diamond rings. Much wealth can be stored in diamonds. In particular, I like the yellow diamonds. The white diamonds, I'm not so crazy about long term. But diamonds, in general, if you look at their track record, they have gone up double digits for the last 40, 50 years, every single year. So there is
Wow.
a tremendous demand for diamonds, and we have more information and even a webinar about diamond investing on our website, ftmdaily.com.
Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, Jerry. Before we close the show, because we have about 10 minutes left, I want you to address the issue of sacrifice. What role has sacrifice played in your personal life? And how important is that for us to embrace in our own lives?
Well, you know, in this most recent election, we saw it was a very sad thing. You know, we saw the church in general focusing a lot of its efforts on the election, on one side or the other. You know, unfortunately, our country is so divided down the racial divide still. We are the only nation that's ever had to go to war to end slavery. I mean, no other nation in history has ever had to kill its own people and gone to war to fight itself just to get rid of slavery, the institution. I mean, that was a horrific event in our nation's history. And the racial tension still exists today. And we can see it in the politics. We can see it in the political divide. That racial divide is right there. So what was interesting during the election was to see that racial tension coming back up in the form of political, ideologies and speeches and anger about, you know, Obama versus Mr. Romney. And the church in general, those who embrace, you know, Washington as a solution, it's so ironic, is that many Christians will adamantly tell you, oh, I don't place my faith, hope, and trust in the government. And yet they do. They do every single time they hold up a picket sign. They do every single time they hold up a political sign. They're putting faith, hope, and trust into the kingdoms of this world. And that's exactly what Samuel, what broke Samuel's heart whenever the people of Israel requested a king, and God said, no, 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 I am your king. And they said, oh, no, no, yeah, you're our king, whatever. We want an earthly king. We want to be like the rest of the nations. And that's fine for the world. If the world wants a king, so be it. That's what do you expect? We don't look at unbelievers and say they have to follow our ways. They don't have to impress us. I think it's ridiculous whenever believers try to get unbelievers to clean the outside of their cup to impress us. I don't care what an unbeliever does. If he, you know, gay marriage and all these things, those are, you know, those obviously are sins. But I can't enforce my legal code or my moral code upon a unbeliever. I mean, his eyes have not been enlightened, as Thomas Jefferson once said. Far be it from me to try to force him to see what I see. You know, he has to come to that revelation on his own, and I want to be there to help. But at the same time, I cannot force him. And that's what we have seen, is this insistence upon using government to solve our issues. And what it has done is, it's back to your issue of sacrifice, is it's masqueraded, it's masked, I should say, the deep problems that we have as believers in this country. We are so wealthy, it's unbelievable. Christians, in many ways, are the most self-flagellating group of people that you can ever find in the world, American Christians, because they know that the Bible talks about persecution. They know that the Bible talks about to be a friend of the world is to be an enemy of God. They know all these things. And yet, they're friends of the world, and yet they don't have any persecution. So they try to invent persecution when they walk into Target and there's no happy, you know, when there's no Merry Christmas, instead it's Happy Holidays. Or when they walk in and they find out the Ten Commandments have been taken down. They're so desperate for persecution because they want to be validated that they're doing something right. And the fact is, they're not. That's why our churches are on the decline. That's why the young people are not being reached. We have been duped. And I think that's the biggest problem that we face today, is that we don't understand the concept of sacrifice. We have gotten, as a nation, very lazy, and we've become so used to being the number one empire in world history, and it's caused a lot of arrogance to rise up in us. Martin Luther King Jr. actually gave a speech on this back during the Vietnam War, and he talked about this, and he said, you know, if you ever believe that that America itself was somehow a divine messianic force to be a policeman of the whole world, that you know, God would raise up a nation that doesn't even know his name to bring justice to this nation. And I believe that's so true. We have become so confident in government. We've become so confident in our military. We've become so confident in our fake dollars that we have lost sight that this kingdom is not the solution, that tweaking it, that reforming it, that changing, you know, rearranging the chairs on the Titanic is not going to stop the ship from sinking. Those who believe the Bible to be literal know that God's kingdom is the solution. We pray in the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Those are not empty words. Those are words that Christ told us and showed us and instructed us to pray. So we're to pray for the kingdom of God to come to this earth. And that is the solution. That requires us to sacrifice this temporal life in many ways. It's very enticing to want to get involved and become a friend of the world and try to reform and change and do all these things. We have to lay that down. We have to realize that we're sojourners in this world, temporary residents, pilgrims, who have one mission and one mission alone, and that is to preach the gospel of Christ. And to do that in the most effective way possible, and not to become entangled in the wiles of this world at the same time. And for many of us, and for what that means for me, it may not mean this for everyone, but for me to do that, I wanted to have the ability to not be stuck in a job where I had to, you know, work and fall into the consumption trap, where I had to obey all of my producer masters, and I had to constantly feed them because they were hungry and they wanted more of my money, and I had to put my money on a conveyor belt and give it to them. Instead, I wanted to break free from that and create value and then use that money to preach the gospel. And that's exactly what God's allowed us to do. Now, I know that everybody has their own calling, but I really do believe by understanding the economic times that we're in and spending a little bit of time educating yourself and getting some financial literacy can pay so many, pay for itself in spades for those who want to truly live out their calling, in these last days, which I believe these are the last days. I know you do too, Daniel.
Yeah. Yes, the kingdom of God is the solution. There is no question about that. Jerry, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. We're just about out of time. I just want to reiterate for everybody that's been listening to the program thus far, Jerry's book is called Bankruptcy of Our Nation. In it, he's going to go into a lot of detail on some of the issues and the things that we've brought up, a lot of very specific facts, references, information, quotes. You'll find the statistics, all these things to illustrate the dire situation our nation is in. A lot of the financial solutions that he teaches on are expounded in this book. And so, you know, if this program has piqued your curiosity, I encourage you, get the book, read it, learn something, and find some ways to apply some of these solutions to your life so that you can, be better prepared financially. And take away from this program that there's more than one way to be prepared, as he's talked about. While gold and silver and storing up food are good things in light of like coming adversity, there are a lot of diversifying activities we can engage in now that will also yield great fruit in the future. And so his website is www.ftmdaily.com. And Jerry, was there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I just really appreciate coming on the program, and I think you're doing a great job. And I just want to tell people, you know, who may be listening to you for the first time who don't know you, that you're a fine young man, and that I know you personally, and I'm really impressed with everything that you're doing, and I know that you're right where you're supposed to be. So it's a wonderful privilege to be, right here with you. So
thank you so much, Jerry. Everyone, you've been listening to Discovering the Truth with Dan Duvall. This is the end of the program. We'll be back next week. I believe that next week we'll be having a guest on the show named Peter Goodgame, and we'll be talking about plenty of interesting topics. Join us 7 o'clock Central Standard Time, 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, a Tuesday night. God bless you. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.